Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Oh, my golly. I've done the thing. I've done the thing that I sometimes do, where I forget to open up the things I need to do the podcast in order to do it. Chapter 29 of Anna Karenina. Are we due for a little mini recap? In other words, I need a little mini recap because I was starting to just gloss over the details a bit in the last few chapters, which is not good. I want to know what's going on. We've got a lot of book left to go, so I don't want to start like not paying attention sort of thing. Sluggy with 3 G's said, I really liked this chapter. Tolstoy often uses traveling as a sort of liminal space for his characters. We saw it a few chapters ago with Levin, and again here with Anna. While traveling, you are physically between two places, but characters are also in this in-between space mentally and emotionally as well. In this in-between space, we can reflect on the past and make new resolutions for the future, or try to convince ourselves that we no longer want the things we have previously desired. We also see that this is often fleeting. When Levin returns to the familiar comforts of his home, it becomes increasingly hard to hold on to the new resolutions he formed while traveling. And in this chapter, Anna seems to be feverishly trying to convince herself that Vronsky means nothing to her. Feverishly trying. Syntax Approval said, I felt this very strongly. It reminded me of the many times in the past where I was traveling long distance and headed home, flying on a plane with many hours to spare. I'd perhaps have my carry-on, a sort of pass-the-flight-in-a-blink-of-an-eye type book by my side, but alas, I continue to read same page over and over again and cannot help but feel distracted and claustrophobic in my thoughts. I start to analyze and extrapolate meaning of the people I've met and the places I've been, things left unsaid, trying to derive a sense of meaning and objectivity in the recent experience. Taking this sort of scenario with Anna, a married woman who is returning to her children, was it just one son? I forget. Her trip is intentionally cut short in shame of having romantic, mildly lewd feelings towards someone else, albeit in a subtle manner. She shared the last dance, the sacred dance, with Vronsky. This has sincerely hurt Kitty. There seems to be a neurotic way that Tolstoy describes her struggle on that train, described as a sort of delirious fever dream. What a grandiose whirlwind of emotion, and the weather outside seems to convey an artistic sort of parallel, and my phone is bedinging. Oh. Apparently there's a new Hamish and Andy podcast out. Thanks, phone. By the way, today's episode is brought to you by the beverage water in a giant milkshake cup. A giant stainless steel milkshake cup that I've had since I was a kid. When we were a kid, my mum bought this milkshake machine. You know the ones? And it had a stainless steel milkshake cup that you would clip on and it would go and zip up. The milkshake machine, I think that died a long time ago, but the giant stainless steel cup is just one of my favourite things that I own. Just have things that you just love owning. This cup has followed me around my house for about 16 or no more, about 20 years. And that's what brings you this podcast tonight. A giant milkshake stainless steel cup full of water. Swim said the mama fishy said. Well, this chapter sent me down some rabbit holes. A paper knife is not the same as a letter opener. Paper knives were used to open book pages that were not cut during the manufacturing process, and they replaced pen knives that were typically used to sharpen a quill. A pen knife would cut the paper inaccurately because of their very sharp blade. Letter openers evolved from paper knives into longer, blunter blades for the sole purpose of opening envelopes. Yeah, I remember in War and Peace, there's a scene where Maya goes and sees her father, old man Bolkonski, and it says something about an uncut book, and that's what that was referring to. The pages are still bound together on the side where you could usually thumb the pages. They're connected, so you need to cut them open. Anna most likely read her novel in English, says Swim, said the mama fishy. Hiring an English governess was quite fashionable among Russian aristocracy during the late 19th and early 20th century. They loved English style. Being able to speak English was considered to be a necessary social accomplishment. French, too, was fashionable among the upper class, so employing an English governess who could speak the language was ideal. Now, this is said in the 1860s, isn't it? The reason I say this, I know War and Peace in 1806, the upper class spoke French, but they spoke it very exclusively, and apparently it was pretty common that among the upper class, the creme de la creme of society, quite a few people wouldn't even know how to speak Russian very well. So they were more fluent in French. Isn't that funny? You don't even speak your own native... You're so posh that you don't even speak your own native tongue. Tolstoy most likely made up the novel Anna is reading. I found a lovely essay by Edwina Cruz. It has spoilers, so I'll paraphrase what relates to this chapter. No evidence has been found that it actually exists. What? The scenes described identify tropes that are the ubiquitous baggage of Victorian novels. These types of novels were in fashion in Russia by the 1860s. Anna imagines herself in the story and wishes to go with the Baron to his estate. She feels shame because she equates the Baron to Vronsky. It's only until she scornfully convinces herself that Vronsky is just a boy soldier is she able to pick the book up again. This was another great descriptive chapter. I felt like I myself was riding on the train, feeling the weather, reading the book, and feeling Anna's emotions. However, based on what we know of Vronsky, he doesn't seem worth it. Techrific gave a mini recap in dot points. 1. The Oblonsky household is in danger due to Steva's affair with the children's French governess. 2. Steva sends for... Wait, let me read that again. The Oblonsky household is in danger due to the Steva's affair with the children's French governess. Oh, okay, yeah. Yeah, like the family is in danger of breaking apart. Steva sends for his sister to mend his relationship with his wife. In order to avoid a painful divorce, appeals to Christian charity and shoes. Levin arrives in Moscow to propose to the 18-year-old Kitty Shcherbatsky, but is gently rejected. Kitty is in love with Vronsky, but he has no intention of marrying her. Upon meeting Anna Karenina, Vronsky falls head over heels in love with her. At a ball, Kitty notices all the attention Vronsky is paying to Anna, and Kitty's hopes are shattered. Anna wants to return to Petersburg in order to avoid Count Vronsky. Is that because she's got a crush on him back and she's also married? JMama8779 said, I would add that while Vronsky is infatuated with Anna, it's not like Anna is interested. She is leaving to avoid the temptation too. Oh, it's not like Anna isn't interested. She's leaving to avoid the temptation. Yeah, she's leaving because she's tempted by a man who her friend is infatuated with, so that will hurt her if they hook up, and also because she's married, and so she probably shouldn't be an adulteress. Soma Stars says, I was really struck by this passage. This is from Maud and Garnet, I'm not sure which one. She got up to rouse herself and slipped off her plaid and the cape of her warm dress. For a moment she regained her self-possession and realized that the thin peasant who had come in, wearing a long overcoat with buttons missing from it, was the stove heater, that he was looking at the thermometer, that it was the wind and snow bursting in after him at the door, but then everything grew blurred again. The peasant with the long waist seemed to be gnawing something on the wall. The old lady began stretching her legs and the whole length of the carriage and filling it with a black cloud. Then there was a fearful shrieking and banging, as though someone were being torn to pieces. Then there was a blinding dazzle of red fire before her eyes, and a wall seemed to rise up and hide everything. Anna felt as though she was sinking down, but it was not terrible, but delightful. There is such a darkness, a madness, in the second portion of that. Reading it made me uneasy, almost like a ghost story or a horror novel. But yet, Anna found it delightful. I feel like there is real foreshadowing here. It feels like foreshadowing a descent into madness, or of one form or another. Swim, said the Mama Fishy, said, this passage feels very gothic, considering that Anna was reading a Victorian English novel that may or may not have had gothic overtones, like Wuthering Heights. Anyone? Yeah, that's what I was getting to, by the way, Swim, said the Mama Fishy, Wuthering Heights vibes. Tolstoy brought into his chapter another Victorian novel trope. Genius. Paper knife caught my eye, says I Am Norwegian, as I'd never heard of that before. Couldn't figure out why you'd need a paper knife to read a book, except as an eccentric bookmark or something. Best I can figure out, she was probably reading an uncut book like this one. Well, there's a picture. Yeah, that's exactly right. It's an uncut book, so there's groups of pages that need to be split apart along the top edge, it looks like, in that picture. Is Anna really unaware of where she comes from? She saw Vronsky's grimace when he approached the Shabatsky household, and Kitty's face when she danced with him, and his attempts to poison himself favorably when they first met. She doesn't strike me as the naive type either. Swim said the Mama Fishy replied to that, saying, well, I'm not naive, and I didn't understand why Anna started feeling shame while she was reading her Victorian novel until I read Cruz's explanation. So it's understandable to me, since I was puzzled why she suddenly was feeling shame. Anna didn't have a helpful scholar to explain it to her. She didn't feel shame when she talked about the dance with Vronsky to Kitty. She felt bad, a much different emotion than from shame. Society isn't even shaming her. Frankly, Anna's emotions are all over the place. Oh, and that note. Oh, that's a big comment. This is from gradesaver.com, says Swim, said the Mama Fishy. And this is going to explain to us everything that's going on in the book, in a mini recap, which is just about the size of the chapter anyway, but let's do it. Oh, here we go. Prince Stephen Oblonsky, known as Steva, wakes up from pleasant dreams to an unfortunate memory. He has slept on the sofa in his study because he and his wife Dolly are having some serious quarrel. 3 days earlier, Dolly discovered that he had an affair with their children's French governess. Since their discovery, she has refused to see him or leave her quarters, and subsequently the house has been chaotic. Though, as he claims, he is only sorry for being caught, Oblonsky despises the uproar that he has inflicted on his house, and on the advice of Matrona, the children's nurse, he makes a rather comic attempt at begging for forgiveness. Dolly, sensing his insincerity, reaffirms her threat to leave for her mother's house with the children. Though upset that his attempts to smooth things over with Dolly have failed, Oblonsky goes on about his duties as head of a governess board in Moscow. He is partially optimistic for his sister Anna Karenina. We'll be coming to visit the next day, and he anticipates that her presence will have a soothing effect on Dolly. Anna's husband is a distinguished government minister in St. Petersburg, and Anna herself is renowned as a lovely and charming woman, and they move in the highest circles in society. During his lunch breaks, Oblonsky runs into his old friend Konstantin Levin, who's just arrived from his country estate and gone straight to Oblonsky's office. Levin has an urgent matter to discuss. He is a shy man and does not wish to talk in front of Oblonsky's business friends. Oblonsky, whose tact and camaraderie with men is well-renowned, quickly discerns that Levin is in town to see Oblonsky's sister-in-law, Kitty Shabatskaya, for Levin is rather smitten with the 18-year-old girl. Oblonsky suggests a meeting with Levin later that evening at the park where Kitty ice skates. Levin has been a particularly reticent suitor, even though he has been in love with the entire Shabatskaya family for many years and has considered marrying all three sisters. After meeting Oblonsky, Levin goes to the half-brother's house. Sergius Ivanovich Koznishev is a well-known writer and intellectual, and he and Levin have trouble getting along. This happens again when Levin arrives. Koznishev is entertaining a professor, and the three of them have a philosophical argument. After the professor leaves, Levin and Koznishev talk about their other brother, Nicholas, the ruined and impoverished pariah of the family. Levin goes to the park. He skates with Kitty and flirts with her boldly, but she sends him mixed signals. Her mother also appears, rather lukewarm about Levin's obvious intentions. Oblonsky arrives and Levin leaves for dinner with relief. They eat at a fine restaurant named the Angleterre. Tolstoy describes the ritual of the meal in great detail. Over dinner, Oblonsky teases Levin about Kitty and they discuss the matter of his proposal. Though he encourages Levin, Oblonsky also tells him about the rival, Count Alexis Kirillovich Kronsky, a wealthy, dashing young officer and imperial aide-de-camp. Oblonsky also admits that he feels little pain at the idea of adultery on behalf of men. Meanwhile, at the Shcherbatskys' house, the elder princess, Shcherbatskaya, frets over Kitty's marriage opportunities. Though she prefers Vronsky, considering Levin peculiar and awkward in public, she fears that Vronsky is not interested in marrying Kitty. Levin arrives and immediately proposes to Kitty. She rejects him in the hopes that Vronsky will make his proposal soon. Other guests soon arrive, and one of them, Count S. Nordston, mocks Levin for his country manners. Levin banters with the countess until Vronsky arrives in the hopes of learning more about his rival. Vronsky is charming, and Levin leaves feeling dejected. After all the guests have left, Kitty's parents argue over her future. Her mother still prefers Vronsky, while her father prefers Levin. Sorry, that was a gross noise. When Oblonsky goes to the railway station to meet Anna the next morning, he runs into Vronsky, who is waiting for his mother to get off the same train. It turns out that Anna and Vronsky's mothers were seatmates in the same compartment, and his mother is quite taken with Anna. So is Vronsky, at once charmed by Anna's spirit and vitality. As the four of them exchange banalities, a railroad guard is run over and killed by a passing train. At the urgings of Anna, Vronsky leaves 200 rubles for the guard's widow. Oblonsky's optimism is well placed. Anna ably convinces Dolly not to leave. She also charms Kitty, but at a ball the next night, Kitty notices that Vronsky is distracted and inattentive to her. The source of this inattention becomes clear when she watched Vronsky waltz with Anna. The two of them are completely smitten, and Kitty's heart is shattered. She realizes that her hopes are shot. Vronsky never wanted to marry her. Levin goes to see his elder brother Nicholas, who is sickly and lives in depraved conditions. Disgusted with the entire trip, Levin leaves Moscow for his country estate. At home, he feels comforted by his servants, his house, and his lands, and he swears that he will be happy without marriage. Anna leaves the same day as Levin on the train for St. Petersburg. She is distressed over her new acquaintance. All right. And that brings us up to date. Whew. That was a good mini summary. I really appreciate you posting that. Swim said the mum fishy. Gunnarul just quickly said, wow, intense chapter. It made me remember being in a situation where a small flirtation with someone unattainable, or so I thought, started to feel like an actual possibility. I remember telling my sister that it felt like a tsunami was coming and it was about to destroy the coastline and change everything, and there was nothing I could do to avoid it. Melodramatic, sure, but there is nothing like that first warning sign that something dangerous but exciting is about to happen. Chapter 30. Let's move on. Let's read the next one. Chapter 30 goes exactly like this. A blustering storm was rushing and whistling between the wheels of the train and round the pillars in the corners of the station. The railway carriages, the pillars, the people and everything that could be seen were covered on one side with snow, and that covering became thicker and thicker. A momentary lull would be followed by such a terrific gust that it seemed hardly possible to stand against it. Yet people merrily exchanging remarks ran over the creaking boards of the platform, and the big station doors were constantly being opened and shut. The shadow of a man stooping slipped past her feet, and she heard a hammer striking the carriage wheels. "Let me have the telegram," came an angry voice from the other side of the storm stormy darkness. "Here, please, number 28, cried the other voices, while many people muffled up and covered with snow ran hither and thither. Two gentlemen passed her with glowing cigarettes between their lips. She took another deep breath to get her fill of fresh air and had already drawn her hand out of her muff to take hold of the handrail and get into the train, when another man wearing a military overcoat came close between her and the wavering light of the lamp. She turned round and instantly recognized Vronsky. With his hand in salute, he bowed and asked if she wanted anything, and whether he could be of any service to her. For some time she looked into his face without answering, and, though he stood in the shade, she noticed, or thought she noticed, the expression of his face and eyes. It was the same expression of respectful ecstasy that had so affected her the night before. She had assured herself more than once during those last few days, and again a moment ago, that Vronsky, in relation to her, was only one of the hundreds of everlastingly identical young men she met everywhere, and that she would never allow herself to give him a thought. Yet now, at the first moment of seeing him again, she was seized by a feeling of joyful pride. There was no need for her to ask him why he was there. She knew as well as if he had told her that he was there in order to be where she was. "I did not know that you were going to. Why are you going?" she asked. "I did not know that you were going to. Why are you going?" she asked, dropping the hand with which she was about to take hold of the handrail. Her face beamed with a joy and animation she could not repress. "Why am I going?" "Why am I going?" he repeated, looking straight into her eyes. "You know that I am going in order to be where you are," said he. "I cannot do otherwise." At that moment the wind, as if it had mastered all obstacles, scattered the snow from the carriage roofs and set a loose sheet of iron clattering, and in front of the deep whistle of the engine howled mournfully and dismally. The awfulness of the storm appeared still more beautiful to her now. He had said just what her soul desired, but her reason dreaded. She did not reply, and he saw a struggle in her face. "Forgive me if my words displease you," he said humbly. He spoke courteously and respectfully, but so firmly and stubbornly that she was long unable to reply. "What you are saying is wrong, and if you are a good man, I beg you to forget it, as I will forget it," she said at last. "Not a word, not a movement of yours will I ever forget, nor can I." "Enough, enough," she cried, vainly trying to give a severe expression to her face, into which he was gazing eagerly. She took hold of the cold handrail, ascended the steps, and quickly entered the little lobby leading into the carriage. But in that little lobby she stopped, going over in her imagination what had just taken place. Though she could remember neither his nor her own words, she instinctively felt that that momentary conversation had drawn them terribly near to one another, and this both frightened her and made her happy. After standing still for a few seconds, she went into the carriage and sat down. The overwrought condition which tormented her before not only returned again, but grew worse and reached such a degree that she feared every moment that something within her would give way under the intolerable strain. She did not sleep at all that night, but the strain and the visions which filled her imagination had nothing unpleasant or dismal about them. On the contrary, they seemed joyful, glowing, and stimulating. Toward morning, Anna, while still sitting up, fell into a doze. When she woke, it was already light and the train was approaching Petersburg. At once, thoughts of home, her husband, her son, and the cares of the coming day, and of those that would follow, beset her. When the train stopped at the Petersburg terminus and she got out, the first face she noticed was that of her husband. Great heavens, what has happened to his ears? She thought, gazing at his cold and commanding figure, and especially at the grisly ears which now so struck her, pressing as they did against the rim of his hat. When he saw her, he came toward her with his customary ironical smile and looked straight at her with his large, tired eyes. An unpleasant feeling weighed on her heart when she felt his fixed and weary gaze, as if she had expected to find him different. She was particularly struck by the feeling of dissatisfaction with herself which she experienced when she met him. It was that ordinary well-known feeling, as if she were dissembling, which she experienced in regard to her husband, but formerly she had not noticed it, while now she was clearly and painfully conscious of it. Yes, as you see. Here is a devoted husband, devoted as in the first year of married life, consumed by desire to see you, said he in his slow, high-pitched voice, and in the tone in which he always addressed her, a tone which ridiculed those who could use such words in earnest. Is Serezha well? She asked. And is this all the reward I get, he said, for my ardour? He is quite well, quite well. All right, there we go, another chapter down. Thank you very much for listening tonight, today, to that. Have your say over at the subreddit, and I will see you tomorrow.